Members, we're going to start with Senator Pogemiller. He has another commitment this morning, so we need to get him in and out of here. So Senator Pogemiller has Senate File 1724, the income tax credit for historic structure rehab.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate it. Senate File 1724 is the historic tax credit. We have had this bill before us over the last few years. It has been included in the omnibus bill several times. It does have a fiscal note, but it can be scaled. The whole idea is to basically piggyback on the federal historic tax credit to incent two things. One, maintenance of current infrastructure. So in that sense, it's kind of a green recycling provision in that it takes historic structures that are on the National Historic Register and puts them into some kind of reuse. And secondly, obviously, if you do set in motion these type of development projects, it does create jobs. The federal credit is a 20% credit. This proposal is a 25% credit. Again, it could be scaled. Eligible projects would have to be listed on the National Register of Historic Places. In addition, they have to be certified as contributing to the National Register Historic District. This is something that historical people can talk about. There's buildings that are in districts, and there's some balance between the historic nature of the whole district versus the individual building. And there are some nuances around that that create differences between state historical societies and national historical societies and local developers. And frankly, some of the projects being considered in Minnesota have some issues related to those differences, and that continues to be worked on. This could provide, if development projects are spurred because of this credit, or as one of the financial packages, you can get some, as a piece of finance packages, you can get some job creation. There are 30 states that provide some kind of incentive, so this is one of the areas where Minnesota is behind in that sense. And I've got numerous people that could testify in this, but I'm going to ask Roger Brooks, who's with the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, is the past chair and has testified previously on this bill before us, to make a brief comment. And coincidentally, I believe, unless Mr. Brooks did this today, the St. Paul paper had a editorial related to this bill, and I'll have that passed out. I frankly just noticed it, Mr. Chairman, because I was having a cup of coffee waiting for the committee to start and happened to notice this. So I don't know if Mr. Brooks got this planted in the St. Paul paper today or not, but there it is.
Mr. Chairman, or Senator Pogemiller, I'm sorry. I'm kind of thinking, as long as the state's going to make, you know, a pretty significant investment in these buildings of state dollars, it almost seems reasonable to require the payment of prevailing wages on the work. Wondering if that's ever been discussed. You've been around this bill for a long time, but
I think depending on where you are in the state, it's a given if it's done kind of in the metropolitan area. You know better than I whether it's something that would work for some of the greater Minnesota projects. But I'm fine with that kind of requirement. Absolutely makes sense to me.
You have a witness, Senator Pogemiller?
Mr. Brooks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Roger Brooks. I'm from St. Paul. And as Senator Pogemiller said, I've been a volunteer in this area of historic preservation for a number of years, and I'm here in that capacity simply to argue that a tax credit for historic preservation is an inherent good, in my opinion. It's a good thing to save historic places. They give us a sense of our past, remind us where we came from, where we are today, gives us pride in place, helps us take care of our neighborhoods and our environment. So we think that's an inherently a good thing. But in addition to that, as this editorial that Senator Pogemiller pointed out by Richard Moe, who is incidentally a native of Duluth and takes a lot of interest in what happens in Minnesota, As he points out in this editorial, this bill goes beyond just saving historic places. It also is a job generator. And I think in these difficult times, that's a thing to take great note of. And not only is it a job creator in normal times, but in times like this, we want to, I think, emphasize those kinds of job stimulus programs that will create the most jobs. And I believe he points out that rehabbing an older house or an older building is more labor-intensive than new construction is, or would be more labor-intensive than a similar number of dollars spent on trying to stimulate manufacturing jobs. And the statistics on this are established in some important studies that have been done in some of those other 30 states that already have a state tax credit, which show some pretty dramatic numbers with regard to how many jobs can be created through a historic preservation tax credit. One other thing I wish to point out is, as Senator Pogemiller alluded to, there is already a federal tax credit of 20% for rehabilitation of historic commercial buildings, and that's been on the books for 30-some years. And Minnesota has taken advantage of that to some degree. But those states that have a state tax credit, they're able to piggyback on top of that federal credit, have leveraged an enormous amount of federal money that we are leaving on the table these days in Minnesota because we don't have the additional incentive. Statistics I saw in Missouri, a state that has 25% tax credit and on which our proposal is based, shows that, this is a study done by Rutgers University, shows that in the year 2007, Minnesota brought in $45 million of this federal tax credit. It's nothing to sneeze at. But Missouri, with this extra incentive, brought in 11 times that amount of federal money, more than a half billion dollars. And the two cities in the nation that lead in the use of that federal tax credit are St. Louis and Kansas City. And I had an occasion to go down and visit and see some of those projects, and they're pretty amazing, particularly in Kansas City, the things that are being done with that federal tax credit being leveraged by the state tax credit. So I think that's something that we in Minnesota are missing out on, and our residents, our citizens, and our developers are working at a competitive disadvantage when the states around us, like North Dakota and Wisconsin and Iowa and particularly Kansas and Missouri, are eating our lunch, in effect. They're attracting capital, which is fluid in this region, for development of historic properties. They are taking, in very impressive ways, old schoolhouses, old hotels, Main Street buildings in small towns, industrial sites in big cities. They're taking those properties and transforming them into useful properties today. And I think that the tax credit, if adopted in Minnesota, would have a similar effect here. It's always difficult to predict in advance what the impact of a single program will be. But I think the evidence from other states like Missouri and Maryland, which is detailed in a report I think you have on your desk by the ABLE Foundation, which is about a 10-page report or evaluation of the impact of the tax credit in Maryland, and other states as well, suggest that this is going to have a positive impact not only on our economy and on saving historic places, but also on revenues that come back to the state. I see we have a fiscal note, which I haven't had a chance to look at in detail, but that fiscal note does not take into account the taxes on wages and the impact over time on property taxes and so forth that bring revenue back into the state and local governments. So I think all that is positive. So I think, Mr. Chairman and members, I think that pretty much covers the important points, and I urge you to take a look at the report from the ABLE Foundation in Maryland, and also note that the states that have existing tax credit programs surround us and that we are at a competitive disadvantage, as shown by the colored map that I think you also have before you. So with
that, Mr. Chairman, just some other little details in here that might want to point out on line 3.1 through 3.3. In lieu of the tax credit, this could also be used as a historic rehab mortgage credit certificate, which is another vehicle for developers or their financiers to take advantage of this piggyback on the federal. And on the fiscal note, you will note that this potentially is not inexpensive. At a 25% rate, this potentially could be a $13 million item. Depending on the development market out there right now, I don't know that many projects would be done in the next year or two. But we could scale that back off the 25% if the committee felt that was a little rich for this session. I think the idea is generally to piggyback off the federal and create some of that gap financing for kind of these complex projects that might not happen because they have historical attachment to them. They're very expensive oftentimes to include these historical buildings in a development. Typically what you're doing is not just that building. You're doing that building as part of a larger development project. And so this is a type of kind of little extra incentive you can put in to make the whole project go. And Mark Phillips from the northern area of the state, Mr. Chairman, would like to make a brief comment.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Used to be from the northern area. Yes. Now he's at Circle Pines.
Right. Correct. Mark Phillips. I'm the Director of Business Development for Carlos Anderson Construction Midwest Group. And I was asked to make a brief comment on the job creation aspects of this legislation. And I may repeat a couple of items. The historic renovations are typically very labor intensive. There's quite a few projects that are on the drawing boards. We're talking to a lot of our customers. There are a number of projects all over the state that we're talking to customers about, and the overwhelming issue is the gap in the financing and why the projects aren't moving forward. I feel that this would actually spring quite a bit of work. Our research indicates that if you just look at all the states that have this state historic tax credit in place, we could probably look at in Minnesota creating about 3,000 construction jobs a year just with this kind of legislation. Again, that's based on a lot of averaging and everything, but I feel very confident that would probably be the case. I have some other facts that in Missouri, in the first 4 years of their tax credit, they created over 6,800 jobs and about $60 million of new tax revenue for the state. Rhode Island, direct construction employment generated by rehab credit projects was 5,334 over 2 years. So this kind of reinforces what I talked about. I'd also just very quickly mention that in some of my past employment, I actually acted as the developer when I worked for Minnesota Power of the Irving School Project in Duluth, which is a federal historic tax credit project. And I can tell you that the financing and Minnesota Power was a very large company, well-heeled company, but the financing to make the numbers work with the revenue on these projects, you have to have some very creative financing. In that case, we were using a lot of low-income and low- to moderate-income housing tax credits. We had the Duluth Historical Fund and their Housing Trust Fund. We had to be very creative to get that project going. So I know personally how difficult it can be to get an historic project financed. But that project now is over 15 years old, and it's employed people and maintenance and upkeep to that property, and it pays property taxes. And so it's I can attest that these are just an excellent use of Minnesota's resources on a return on investment basis.
Mr. Chairman, there are others that can answer questions if need be and stand for questions.
Senator Pogelmiller, it's not a small amount of money, $28 million in 10 and 11. But when the tax bill comes out next week, I know the press is probably watching and they're probably writing the story about the big tax increase that's going to be in this year's tax bill. But I would like there to be a another emphasis of the tax bill, and that be a job creation component. I mean, if we are ever going to get out of this recession, we have to find a way to put people to work. And so I'm very interested in this and some of the other bills that we have on the agenda today, because this tax bill needs to be about more than just balancing the budget. It needs to be about how are we going to put Minnesota back to work. So, Senator Pogelmeier, we're going to see if we can find a way to fit, if not the bill, some version of the bill into the committee bill. And we'll be talking about that as committee members some probably tomorrow. So does anybody else feel like they want to testify on the bill? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pogelmeier, if we were to put this just so we piggyback on the federal credit, would that mean that we would just allow this for commercial buildings? Did I hear the testifiers say that?
No, the proposal, Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy, the proposal would include residential buildings as well in Minnesota, as is true of most of the state tax credits that exist around the country.
Mr. Chair, what does the federal tax credit apply to? Does that apply to residential also?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy, that applies only to commercial buildings.
Only to commercial.
Mm-hmm. But, Mr. Brooks, I'm in order to try and narrow the cost, is there a way we can craft this so it doesn't apply to just a single family standalone residence? I mean, what I kind of envision, Senator Skoy, is taking a big warehouse in downtown Minneapolis and converting it to maybe a couple hundred units of housing. So I don't want to exclude residential, but is there some way to define this so that we exclude the homes on Summit Avenue, for example?
Let me have Mr. Herman, John Herman, who does a lot of legal work around development projects, respond.
Mr. Herman?
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Herman. I'm a lawyer with Fager and Benson. I have represented a substantial number of projects that have taken advantage of the federal credit. Just to that specific question posed by Senator Skoy, the federal credit's not available for a single-family residential property that's owner-occupied. So if you took out the special provisions in our bill that dealt with that, obviously it would have implications in that regard. Maybe I could say a couple of other things about the bill, if the committee would allow me, that I think would be helpful in your deliberations. As I believe some of the material you have indicates, over half the states now have this credit. What I'm beginning to experience with my clients who are trying to sell Minnesota credits is that they are disadvantaged in the market because credit buyers in Missouri or in any of the other 25 states are getting a double header with the state and the federal credit and in buying the credits in those places. So our market is disadvantaged, and Minnesota companies are comparatively disinclined to buy these credits. I think if we could piggyback them with this state credit, it would create a Minnesota-based market, and it would not only give you the direct benefit of the adding the two credits together, it would actually give us a better realization on the price that the credit buyers pay that would go into the projects. For your own information, in terms of thinking about the fiscal impact, this credit comes into play only when the property is placed in service. It's not available when the project goes into construction. So if you assume that most of these projects have a 12 to 18 month construction period and certainly a few months to get going, I think the scoring that the Revenue Department has done on it, indicating big costs in 2010 and 2011, may not be accurate, because we don't have a lot of these projects in the pipeline right now. And so I think that the projects that are generated by the more readily available credit will come online maybe more in the 12 and 13 budget period. So the cost
at completion
of the project. Because, and of course, you know, if the project's completed in 13, the tax returns filed in 14, you know, you may not actually see such a big revenue implication in the current period. I think it'd be worthwhile asking them to think about that. And also, I can tell you that we have a lot of projects that have gaps now. I know the committee probably has heard about the low-income housing pipeline, the loss of value of the low-income housing credit. And if we could add this for those projects where these credits are combined, which is frequently the case in rural Minnesota. We have a lot of commercial buildings in downtowns in rural Minnesota where the conversion, as the chair has suggested, is to rental housing, often with low-income credits as part of it because they have, you know, 20% at 50 or 40% at 60. And if we could increase the value of the whole credit package on those projects, I think we could get quite a few of them that are now sitting waiting for the numbers to work for them, because, you know, the whole credit market has cratered in the last couple of, in the last 6 to 8 months with the departure of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac from the credit buying group. And if we could get a little bit more value out of the credits here, we could make a lot of those projects happen. I work on many projects where this would really help. These projects are incredibly hard to do because frequently they make you do all kinds of unique things. Let's take the Ivy Tower project I did a couple of years ago. The Ivy Tower is very small. It cost over $1 million just to shore the building up while we built a bigger building next door. The renovation costs to link that building into modern fire protection systems and provide it with elevator access was exceptional and extraordinary. We did use tax increment on that project and also a fair amount of pollution abatement funding from the Met Council for asbestos removal. But I think that there are many cases where just a little bit more for these projects would push a great many of them into use. So I hope the committee will give serious consideration to it. Can I just raise one small issue that we're continuing to talk to the author and the Historical Society about, and that is there are some projects that are in districts and the individual project may meet these requirements, but everything happening in the rest of the district may not, like the Pillsbury A Mill. And we'd like to try to come up with a way to include some of those unique projects in the possibility for the credit as well, and I hope we can work on an amendment to do that.
Is anybody here from revenue that can speak to the revenue impact of this? Senator Pogelman, my question is, I wonder if the reason it has a significant impact in 10 and 11 is because of the carry back provision in the bill.
That could be.
And I wonder if we took the carry back provision in and only allowed the credit going forward, if we couldn't score more of the money in 12 and 13 here and lessen the current biennium. I'm not sure the carry back provision is critical. That might be the reason it's scoring in 10 and 11, because people are take that credit against tax liability going back 3 years. But we'll ask revenue that question. But I have to believe that would create some different scoring of the bill. And I need to go to finance. They're calling and calling and calling. But
Chairman, I think we're good to go here. So,
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pogemiller, on, or maybe to the witness probably, on page 2, lines 1 and 2, they're talking about this 50% of the total basis of the property. So the rehabilitation has to exceed 50% of the basis on the property when they start. Does that also, is that number also conform with the federal credit, or is that number different?
That number conforms to the federal number where you have to do a rehabilitation that exceeds 50% of the non-land basis of the property. Yes.
Of the non-land basis.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Wong?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that Senator Bach had indicated that he's interested in perhaps trying to undo some of the residential applications. Part of the reason why I went on this bill is because I thought that this might be an interesting opportunity for us. You know, I've been convening these housing work groups throughout the summer, and one of the areas that we looked at is how do we incentivize people to reinvest in a lot of our, like I represent historic Dayton's Bluff, and a lot of those historic homes are owned by families who've been putting their own resources into it. And so while I understand Senator Bach's desire to want to look at how we narrow the bill down, I would be willing to work with Senator Pogemiller on looking at this because I don't want to disadvantage the families who have been using their own resources in looking at these historic homes.
But Senator Wong, I like the bill. My only concern is the $28 million. And I think maybe, I think members of our caucus, when we spend $28 million of this, are going to say, what's the tax committee doing? Mm. It comes back to the job creation emphasis that somewhere has to come out of this legislature. But I think maybe we'll ask revenue that maybe the carry back provision is why it's scoring so much money in 10 and 11. I think we might be able to probably get that revenue's impact down some just by removing the carry back and having it go forward. But
Mr. Chairman, look forward to working with the committee on this and see if we can come up with something that's workable this session.
Any other questions, members? Thank you. Thank you, Senator Pogemiller. Chair lays Senate File 1724 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Appreciate it.
Senator Olson. Welcome to the Tax Committee. Starting with Senate File 1450.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Both the two bills that I'm here to talk to you about today, members, are exactly as Senator Bach said, they're bills related to jobs in Minnesota. And the first of these, Senate File 1450, is a bill that was actually patterned after what the state of Minnesota has done in the past to preserve jobs in the taconite industry. And essentially, as I think many of us are familiar, certainly Senator Skoy and I are familiar, the forestry products industry in northern Minnesota has really taken a heavy hit as a result of the downturn in the housing industry, and that coming on top of some other difficulties that the forestry industry has struggled with. And so as a result, the Ainsworth plant in the Bemidji area and elsewhere and a number of other forest products or wood products facilities have closed and, as far as we know, are permanently closed under their present ownership. And that came after, just a couple of years ago, these facilities were here asking for the state to forgive some contract obligations they had as a result of stumpage prices having gone suddenly south and having obligations to pay that stumpage at a much higher rate than they felt was sustainable in the marketplace. So the state worked with the forest products industry really in an attempt to preserve those jobs here for Minnesota, and yet that inevitably didn't occur. So what this bill does is it would require wood products facilities to be maintained in a saleable operating condition for at least 2 years after the plant has been permanently closed, rather than taking and stripping the equipment and infrastructure from these locations, making it probably inevitable that these jobs will never return to Minnesota. Without this bill, the owners of these plants, who are, in Ainsworth's case, for example, a Canadian company, are unlikely to want to sell to a competitor, what would be then a competitor, in order to keep these jobs available in Minnesota. So that's, in a nutshell, what the bill would do. The intent is to preserve the availability of these jobs in Minnesota so that when the housing market turns around, as we know it eventually will, we have the opportunity to keep these jobs within our economy.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Questions, members? Well, Senator Olson, I think you have a pretty reasonable initiative here. From my perspective, part of the issue is that if we're going to do good silviculture forest management, you know, part of that is harvest. And when you're going to harvest the forest products, you have to have a wood products facility to run those. So I think it's a pretty good initiative. Seeing no other questions, anybody else that would like to speak on Senate File 1450?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, just I'm trying to catch up here. Just so that I generally understand it, if I owned a wood products facility and it was not doing well right now, and I had an opportunity to at least sell the facility, the business had probably gone away. I could not do that under this bill. I would have to remain at least in some sort of a state of neutral flux for 2 years until I did that. Is that what this says? I'm probably trying to read it too quickly.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, no, not at all. If you had a buyer for that facility, you would be perfectly free to sell the facility under this bill. What you would not be able to do for that two-year period would be to strip all of the infrastructure from the real estate, essentially making that making it impossible that facility would ever again be used for the purpose that it was there, for example, as an OSB plant for the Ainsworth facility. Once that very expensive infrastructure has been stripped, the odds are that, you know, no company is ever going to purchase that piece of real estate and use it again for that purpose. And considering the investment the state, and I should say as well, county governments, because certainly our counties are also very dependent on the income that they earn from managing their timber sales as well. So if there are no plants or many fewer plants for to process the timber, then that income goes away, not just from the state, but also from county units of government. As well as Senator Skoy pointed out, we really depend on those jobs, not just for their value to the economy, but that's how we manage the resource so that it's we don't end up with excessive forest fires and all kinds of things that can happen.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Senjum, as you're catching up on the bill, there's also a Business Venture Capital Revolving Fund established and unspecified appropriation.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
that's the next bill.
Senator Johnson, that's the next bill.
Sorry.
Okay, any other questions, members? Thank you. Chair lays over Senate File 1450 for possible inclusion. And Senator Olson, Senate File 1764.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senate File 1764 has been a work in progress for me, actually, for a couple of years. As I've talked to mayors, people who work in economic development, city planners, and other people in my community about what we could try to do to stimulate job growth. As this committee knows, we've had a program called JobZ for rural Minnesota, and there have been some successes in my community, but it certainly hasn't established the vibrant economy that we would have liked to have seen. And there's been a feeling by many in our community that it really isn't there and available for the small business entrepreneur who already lives or exists in the community and really needs just a little bit of help getting started. The whole idea of economic development is something that I certainly wasn't an expert about when I came to the Senate. But in being a member of Senator Tomassoni's committee and talking to those who work in this area, it really struck me that in a meeting I had back in Bemidji this summer, someone who is an expert in this area was just explaining that, you know, in the 1800s, we really had an agricultural-based economy. In the in the last century, our economy really was based on manufacturing. And to be competitive in the next century, in the century we're just beginning now, we really are going to have more of an idea-based economy. And what the and so those ideas aren't necessarily going to be a big company coming in and providing manufacturing jobs. They may very well be that student graduating from college in our local neighborhood who's got an idea of something that he wants to get going. Or it might be a community that has a project for redevelopment, whether it's an area or a building that needs a little bit of capital to get the project off the ground. Or it might be a new idea that we have related to our emphasis on developing a green economy, some new way of using biofuels, for example, in northern Minnesota are becoming there are people working on how we can use the resources that we have in our local area to try to develop a new what will eventually be a new business and provide new jobs for that area. And so in talking about how we would design an economic development approach to try to help and assist that kind of growth and development, I've been kind of gathering ideas, and that eventually led to this bill. I should say, however, that this is not a bill that's designed specifically for rural Minnesota, because it's not geographically limited in any form. It's both broader than what we have under Job Z, because it has it's available anywhere in the state, potentially, but it's also more targeted because the criteria that we asked job or the deed to look at in awarding grants would be based on the merits of the project, based on some criteria that are laid out in the bill that I'll go through, but also based on the level of unemployment and the median household income in the area where the grants, from which the grants have been requested. So the idea would be that a local unit of government, whether a county or a city, would identify a specific idea in its area, whether it's a building that could be rehabbed into something like we have the global market here, marketplace here in the Twin Cities, whether it's a specific, whatever the specific idea and business might be. And then that idea would be measured or the local unit of government would make a grant application through deed, and the eligibility criteria are listed on subdivision 5. Specifically, we would be looking at perhaps a business that would be located in an area or a building that is in need of redevelopment or restoration. So it might even be something like Senator Pogemiller was discussing, or it could just be a building that, say, for example, is maybe dragging down the rest of the businesses in that area because it really needs it needs to have it's kind of a blight on the community, and I think that's especially relevant today with a lot of the foreclosures that we've had. It could be something that the second criteria, eligibility criteria, is something that uses federal stimulus money. And the reason that that's a criteria is because whenever we can bring additional federal funds in, that's benefiting our state. Something that would assist with meeting Minnesota's renewable energy standards is the third criteria, again, because that's something that as a state we have an interest in promoting. Number four could be related, reduces greenhouse gases and dependency on fossil fuels. Again, that's a policy objective that the state wants to promote. Number five, assists resident entrepreneurs and businesses to initiate or expand in a manner that creates sustainable jobs compatible with the resources available in an area. Again, that's a fairly broad criteria, but we're looking at something that will assist people who are already living in a community, people we already have here who need that kind of help. Number six, supports research and development of innovative non-traditional uses of resources available in an area, somewhat related to number five. Seven, integrates support services and businesses in a central location. And there, again, I was thinking of kind of that global marketplace type of model. Number eight reaches out to a certain populations that are underrepresented in the workforce, because whenever we can target specific groups, whether it's women who are or whether it's a specific cultural group, we're helping to boost an area of the economy that or boost a group of people that we want to be working in taxpaying citizens that might need a little bit of additional assistance. And so, again, this is not necessarily a list that is exhaustive. There may be other ideas that could be incorporated into this bill, but these are all policy initiatives, and I think things I've heard us talk about as a legislature that are good policy objectives we would like to incent. And then subdivision six is the provision that explains how this money would be targeted. In weighing the grant application, indeed, we would be specifically trying to target these funds to the community based on the unemployment rates and the average household incomes, so that we are making the money available where it's really needed the most. Obviously, the more money that we had available in a program like this, the more widely we could disperse it. If we only had a little bit of money available, it would be assumed that it would go to the areas that were the most in need of that kind of assistance. The type of assistance that's available is described in Subdivision 7. What it would be is a grant from the state to the local community to be distributed as a low or no interest loan, a venture capital type of loan to the business, whether it was for rehabbing the building or, again, that would be described in the grant application, the type of assistance that would be the most needed. So there would be a lot of flexibility in based on how the funds were the most needed. And the reason that this type of assistance was put in the bill was, I remember when we were at the beginning of this session, we were at the Humphrey Institute, they were talking about the fact that Minnesota really doesn't have as many venture capital or venture types of economic development projects as many other states have, and that we really don't have the programs in place to try to stimulate that kind of project. And of course, we all know with the economy today and with it being so difficult to obtain financing, that this is probably the most helpful kind of thing we could do to try to stimulate money, is by making that initial capital available. And also, it's not a giveaway project. It doesn't place any financial stress on the area that would be receiving this. It's not a tax credit in the sense that we would have property coming off the tax rolls for both the state or the local government. It would be in the form of a loan that would eventually be repaid. And then the last, or at some point in this bill, there's some language that talks about that the community would be given preference for if they were successful in
Line 33, Senator Olson.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Line 233 says priority for fund distribution to the local government units. They would be prioritized if they've demonstrated success in implementing the program in the past. So there would be an incentive for the local unit of government not to just not be careful in how this money was distributed, because if the money were not repaid, they would be less likely to receive a second grant in the future. Mr. Chair, Senator Bach had looked at this proposal and asked that it be referred to his committee with the possibility that that there would be some way to find some way to fund this project. I'm going to be presenting it in finance very shortly, as soon as I leave this committee. I think the intent is going to be just to be able to, because they don't have any money in that committee, they'll probably strip out the language with the appropriation and then refer it here for this committee to decide how to handle at that point.
And Senator Olson, if it was a fixed dollar amount that was appropriated for this, would the applications be funded on a first-come, first-serve or a prorated basis, or what are your thoughts there?
Mr. Chair, my thoughts are that they would be funded based on the merits of the applications using the criteria that are in the bill. So in other words, it isn't the intention that a grant application would have to meet all of these criteria. It might only meet one, or it might meet them more broadly. But I would assume that the grant applicant would attempt to present the grant in a way to relate to as many of these criteria as would apply. And so the strength of that application in relation to these criteria, as well as the criteria in Subdivision 6, the rate of unemployment and the average household income, would be factored in making that determination. So there is quite a bit of discretion given to DEED. There isn't anything that specifically says, the grant would be in a specific amount or how many grants would have to be made. Again, I guess that would be up to this committee to decide, and I would certainly be very open to your thoughts about, if this committee felt more guidance, then that should be given to DEED.
And so, Senator Olson, you're envisioning a kind of a once a year grant, giving of the grants, and the department would get all the applications for that year, and then start prioritizing off how they meet these eligibility criteria and do the top of the pile, and if when they run out of money, then the rest of them don't get done. Is that what you're envisioning?
Mr. Chair, that's what I was envisioning.
Okay. Questions, members? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a suggestion. In the criteria, Subdivision 5, I was looking at criteria number 3 on line 2.15 and 2.16. My suggestion would be to also add the energy conservation goals that we've adopted as a state, because there are a number of innovations and entrepreneurs and technological advances that will be coming to market as a result of those goals that we set forth as well. That's not just turning down thermostats, that's innovations in building envelope technology or distributed energy resources or the like. So I was wondering if you'd be open to amending to add that as well.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a great suggestion. I would assume at line 2.16, then what would be added would be just before the semicolon, and energy conservation goals as set forth in section, and I'm not sure what the section would be.
216B.2401.
216B.2401.
Yeah.
I would certainly appreciate that amendment.
Well, I'll offer that amendment.
Senator Olson, Senator Dibble, we technically don't have bill in the committee. It's in finance. This is an informational hearing. So, we'll get the language back, and that'll be at some future point in time, or maybe in finance you'd want to consider adding that, Senator Olson.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, and to that, just on page 2, line 11, you might want to strike is and then put is in front of located on line 12. That's really kind of just style, but that makes the whole thing read mm-hmm. better. So.
Any other questions? Well, anybody else who'd like to speak on Senate File 1764? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Olson. Good luck in finance, and we'll look forward to some language coming from that committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Oh, wow.
Senator Anderson.
Yes. We just have Senator Rosen left, I think. Yeah.
Welcome to the committee, Senator.
Thank
Anderson.
You. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate File 1232 is a green job zones bill. And this is, I believe, a new improved version over what I introduced last year, which was kind of a last year the bill that I wrote was more of a was sort of a green makeover of Job Z. This year, I'm focusing much more narrowly in a very targeted way on recruiting incenting green manufacturing jobs to our state, as I said, in a very narrow, targeted way. So what this bill would do, number one, it has statewide application, so anywhere across the state would be eligible. But the criteria for the type of business and the location of business that would be eligible for tax exemptions are very, very narrow. So number one, it would only be eligible for green manufacturing companies. And if you look at the first engrossment, sections 16 has the definitions, page 19, and 19.19 goes through the definitions of what we mean by a green manufacturing business. And essentially, we wanted to target manufacturing jobs and that are green, and we wanted to target them to locations that are sitting vacant and unused. So the idea would be that we'd be focusing on places around the state that have lost their manufacturing capability because of outsourcing or recessionary trends. So the only locations where these tax advantages would apply would be at a shutdown manufacturing plant, a vacant manufacturing facility, or a brownfield site that was formerly developed as an industrial site. Or the third category is the Ford plant in particular, which I designated as sort of its own category, because the idea is that we are trying, if that plant, when we finally figure out what its future is, we would like it to be retooled as a green manufacturing site. And so if that eventuality were to happen, it would be eligible as well. This comes from a lot of discussion we had in the Green Jobs Task Force, and one of the things we heard over and over is that our state has not been as successful as it should be at attracting manufacturing jobs or at attracting green businesses, at marketing our advantages and at capitalizing on those, even though we have all the different parts of the puzzle that should make us really a leading state in this area. And so this is one of the things that we need to focus on. We've done a good job of increasing the market for renewable energy and clean water technology and biofuels. We have a lot of development of those areas, a lot of production, but we don't have the manufacturing base that accompanies those. We have a little bit of it, but we can do so much better. And those are the jobs that are the good-paying jobs that we can revitalize our manufacturing base and our economy with. For example, we talked a lot about solar, and solar power being a really growing, fast-growing sector of the renewable energy world, and the potential is enormous. Minnesota, like a lot of states, are looking at putting incentives in place for development of more solar. Xcel Energy is looking at doing a lot more solar to meet the renewable energy standard. But most of those solar panels that are being installed are imported from China. And it's time for us to manufacture those in Minnesota. I'm aware of several companies, and I wasn't able to get representatives of them here today, although some of them have appeared at other hearings. I know of a solar panel manufacturing company that wants to open up in the Twin Cities, that has a new innovative way to manufacture that will concentrate the energy so that it will be more productive and more energy capacity for the same amount of investment. Another company that wants to develop a modern kind of storage, small-scale storage technology that you could use with solar or wind or other renewables that are intermittent, if you had a small advanced battery or storage component, you could make use of that power 24/7. And so we have a company that wants to open an advanced storage manufacturing facility right in St. Paul. This kind of incentive could make it happen. So this is really a way to say that we're open for green business. And so, members, I would one more thing I should say about it is that the tax incentives that it offers are state tax incentives. So it relates to income and sales tax, other kinds of state taxes that a manufacturing business would have to pay. I don't include any local property tax changes, and I think that should be left up to the local level. So that's how it's very different, I think, from a conventional Jobsy approach, because it is so targeted. I have one witness who'd like to speak briefly.
Senator Anderson, are the tax incentives comparable to what the business would have received under a Jobsy if they would have met the other criteria?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So we do, that's the similarity, is that we use the state tax incentives that would be available under Jobsy, but not any local ones.
Not the local property.
And as you can see from the fiscal note, this, because it's so targeted to green companies that are manufacturing companies that locate at an old industrial site or a vacant site, it's very targeted, and so the fiscal impact is a lot smaller than sort of a wide-open approach. I should mention one more thing before I introduce Mr. Dibvig, is that I have my little note I've been carrying around that Senator Erickson Ropes gave me last summer, where she said in 1 month in her district they lost 400 jobs in two different manufacturing plants, one in Winona, one in Spring Grove. And it's a perfect example of why this is not a Twin Cities issue. This is a statewide issue. We have places that have lost manufacturing jobs all around our state that have sites sitting vacant. And so I think one of the criticisms of Jobsy has been it doesn't target its resources to where they're needed the most. And I think this bill really tries to address that head on. I have John Dibvig from the Blue-Green Alliance who'd like to speak briefly in support of it.
Mr.
Thank you.
Dibvig. Thank you. I'm
John Dibvig with the Blue Green Alliance, which is a national partnership between labor unions and environmental groups dedicated to expanding the number of quality green jobs in the United States. We have more than 6 million union members and environmentalists nationwide who are in pursuit of green, good jobs, a clean environment, and a green economy. And we've all here in Minnesota seen the employment figures. According to the Department of Employment and Economic Development numbers in Minnesota, we lost 13,300 jobs in February. 5,100 of those jobs were in manufacturing. Job losses year over year shows Minnesota down 25,700 in the manufacturing sector. And manufacturing has lost jobs for 12 straight months. This is longer than just the most recent economic downturn. According to a January 2009 study by the Metropolitan Council, the metropolitan area from 2000 to 2008, manufacturing shrank 17.6% for a net job loss of 38,100. Globally, green manufacturing is seen as the best opportunity for a long-term, stable manufacturing job growth. Senate File 1232 is an opportunity to target the scarce resources to where they have the greatest opportunity for long-term growth. Help from other sources is already underway. Right now, the Blue-Green Alliance is engaged in a green manufacturing process, thanks in large part to funding from the state legislature, where we're taking a look at manufacturing and what we can do to try and implement or get more green manufacturing here in the state of Minnesota. One of the big things that's already come out is that we need to try and coordinate a lot more with the state and the municipalities and try and come up with ways of inducing or encouraging green businesses, green manufacturing, to locate here in Minnesota. We've identified 29 product lines that have great opportunity for growth, and we're working on other plans. A great example of a green manufacturer who was encouraged to come to Minnesota is a business called Innovent. They make a ventilation system that's an air exchanger, and it takes the fresh air from the outside and exchanges it with the dirty air from inside of buildings. But as it does that process, it also exchanges the heat. And so the stale air that's going out is dropped down to ambient air temperature outside, and the fresh air that's coming in is brought up to ambient air temperature inside the building, saving a lot of energy, obviously. Innovent located in Minneapolis. in part because of the dedication that they saw to that city to the new green economy. Green manufacturing is looking for signals, and as Senator Anderson just mentioned, this program would be a great signal to send to green manufacturers throughout the country. And thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Anderson, the question that occurs to me on all of these, and I'm glad Senator Rosen is here because I'm going to ask the same question of her, is if the tax incentives are the same for this program as the JobZ program had, the only difference is instead of rural distressed, we now are going after empty manufacturing sites, but all of these businesses would have qualified for the JobZ tax benefit if they would have located in a rural distressed area. Why didn't they take advantage of that?
Mr. Chair, I think the idea is that it's narrowly targeted so that we'd get better bang for our buck. Sure, any company could have qualified for JobZ, I suppose, but when we're targeting locations that have shut down, then what you have is a facility in place. You have the infrastructure in place. You also have a workforce in that community. And so you have some advantages over just picking any old site that may or may not have those advantages. I think with the sort of general JobZ approach, you could go and, you know, dig up a greenfield and start from scratch to open your business. And this would target it so that it would be making use of existing infrastructure, existing workforce, and that gives an edge, I think.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, I came in a little late, so maybe you already covered this, but You had stated that some of these business sites where this would apply were in regards to businesses that failed prior to the economic distress that we're now going through. And has there been any discussion of whether or not or done any market studies of why those businesses failed? What products were they making that they didn't sell anymore? Was there any discussion of that so that maybe we don't have to rebuild everything, we just have to look at what the companies are presenting to the public for purchase?
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I guess I can't give you a broad answer. That's a really big question about why we're losing manufacturing jobs all around our state, and there's a lot of factors for a lot of these businesses. I can talk about St. Paul, where we've lost over 80% of our manufacturing jobs over the last decade or so, over 80%. And you can look at the old blue-collar job machines that we had on the east side of St. Paul. You know, the Whirlpool, 3M's laid off and shut down some of its lines. We've lost a lot of those. And then the Ford plant, which is on life support. And it's still struggling along, and it's still open, but they've announced its closure numerous times. And I think it's pretty clear that most of those manufacturing facilities have lost out to global competition, to cheaper labor, cheaper prices overseas for consumer products. And that is, that's a broad trend that's affected a lot of manufacturing jobs and a loss of our industrial base in the United States. You could go on and talk about trade laws. There's a whole range of issues that affect these things, and I can't tell you what they all are. You know them as well as I do. Well, but I think part of the antidote for that is, and I make sure I always say, green jobs aren't the only good jobs. A good job is a good job. But the green sector, the green economy, is one of the greatest growth areas in this decade across the world. It's an incredible growing opportunity. And so because Minnesota is so well positioned with our policies that we have in place to promote renewable energy, biofuels, clean water, because we have so many strengths in those areas, this we should be positioned. If we want to regrow an industrial base, this is an area where we should be able to be successful, despite some of those long-term trends that make for a lack of competition, you know, that make it hard for us to be competitive.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Lemmer.
Senator Anderson, will these jobs survive without a government subsidy?
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lemmer, I think the answer would be these jobs are going to be, these companies are going to build in the United States. Mm-hmm. That's the growth of the green economy is so enormous, and the growth of renewable energy and clean energy technologies. The question is where. So I think it's about whether they choose to come here or they choose to go other places. I think they will survive, and they're going to grow with the trends that we have now.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Sometimes I look at some of these these provisions under Job Z, and I see the subsidies, but all I really see is just a shift of government funds to promote a business that stays around for a while, and if we don't keep feeding the business, it would collapse on its own. We've seen it throughout our state history on some of the projects that have been up in the Iron Range area. And as much as I really sincerely believe on diversifying the economy in rural areas, which is absolutely needed to keep jobs and population in rural Minnesota, when the subsidies go away, the corporations go away. And I think that's been the experience up in northern Minnesota. Your witness said that green jobs was the best method to restore jobs to Minnesota. Could you tell me where that source came from to justify that statement, that it's the best, the green jobs are the best method to restore jobs to Minnesota? Where did you get that figure from?
Well, I think what it is looking at kind of international trends, and that there is an awful lot of talk out there right now that internationally we have a problem with global climate change. And part of the solution to global climate change is changing a lot of the way that manufacturers are doing things and are utilizing energy. I think that the other thing in just looking forward a little bit in the United States, there's being discussion right now of cap and auction legislation, which is a way of getting people who are using carbon to pay the full freight for using that carbon. When that comes into effect, I think that will also affect a very large shift in manufacturing, and a lot of the manufacturing that is happening currently will have to try and make changes in order to be using less carbon and thereby becoming more green. There also then will be a larger demand for these green products.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Anderson, I think that the state has a role in attracting diverse jobs to our state. I mean, we do. But this committee has questioned the effectiveness of the Job Z type tax incentive. And you know, maybe there's a better mechanism that we could be instituting that would achieve the goal that we want. And I think we've looked at the success of the Job Z tax incentive with lots of questions as to how successful it has been. And so, you know, when I, the committee will ponder on this again, because we're, as the chair said earlier today, we're going to have a jobs component in the Senate tax bill. But we do need to make sure that we're doing this the best and the wisest that we can.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson,
if I may, I've been a skeptic on Job Z as well, so for many years, and so I sort of so I hear where you're coming from, and I think in an ideal world, targeted investments might be more effective than tax breaks. If we are going to use state dollars, if we believe that there's a role for economic development to give incentives to very targeted approaches to business development, But I think it's kind of the only possible game in town right now. And so that's what we're focusing on. And I think there's definitely interest in the business community. I think the way we can really correct some of the flaws of the JobZ program, I believe, are to target it very narrowly so that we're not just throwing money out there for any business, so that we're focusing on the types of businesses that will add value to our economy in locations that really need them. And so that's one way to improve upon maybe what we've done in the past. But I hear what you're saying. Absolutely. I have Lynn Hinkle is here, and I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you have time for a couple more minutes of testimony. And there was a little mix-up.
Sure, briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for this opportunity to speak in support of Senate File 1232. My name is Lynn Hinkle. I'm a retired auto worker, still active in developing green job opportunities.
Could you give us your last name again, please?
Sure. My full name is Lynn Hinkle, H-I-N-K-L-E.
Thank you.
And as I indicated, I'm a retired auto worker, still active, developing green job opportunities for Minnesota in general and green manufacturing options for the Ford site in particular. I might also add that I'm currently co-chair of the Labor Committee of the National Climate Prosperity Project, which is intentionally looking at these kind of templates in other states around the country as well as Minnesota. I applaud the efforts to promote Green Job Zone and Senator Ellen Anderson's longstanding leadership to translate Minnesota's nationally recognized environmental standards into equally impressive economic development. Senate File 1232 sends a clear message that Minnesota is open for green business. Other states have had preliminary success translating global warming mandates into good green jobs, but Senate File 1232, as part of a larger green economic development program, signals Minnesota's intent to capture significant value in this new market. This is important. As our state continues to shed family-sustaining manufacturing jobs at an alarming rate, the good news is that the new energy economy and many of the clusters, such as solar PV and wind turbines, are still in play. And with the right set of targeted tools, as Senator Anderson was talking about, such as tax-abated green job zones, Minnesota can emerge a new economic engine linked to its environmental leadership. Let me say before I discuss some possible enhancements to the bill before you that it provides incentives for either a single-use or a mixed-use green conversion of the Ford site. Clearly, the shorter-term stimulative effect of a single-use conversion would be preferable, but a longer-term mixed use with green manufacturing could still create as many family-sustaining jobs building solar panels or wind turbines or light rail vehicles or perhaps a mixture of all of those things. The question of what resources are needed to achieve this is important. Recently, I presented information to the solar industry stakeholders convened by the Office of Energy Security about the prospects of a solar PV manufacturing cluster in Minnesota. In analyzing dozens of startups around the country and expansions in other states, it's worth noting that the public-private mechanisms used by Sunlight in Toledo, Polysilicon in Pennsylvania, and the Solar Resource Center in Ulster, New York, have created significant value in their partnerships between the state and the private sector. Sunlight's manufacturing launch was enabled by a rapid and well-timed public infusion of funds as tax incentives, approximately $2 million from Ohio in loan guarantees, $5 million from bonds and grants, added with another $7 million in tax incentives. This leveraged at least twice that amount in private capital calculated to develop a couple hundred early-stage direct jobs and a significant number of indirect. But just as important, these indirect jobs in Toledo are going to help develop a supply cluster, and I think that's the significance in the development of a potential solar PV manufacturing cluster in the state of Minnesota. Senate File 1232 deserves your support as an important complement to other mechanisms that together correlate to the scale and complexity of green manufacturing needs and are timed to consolidate green clusters quickly. Thank you very much for permitting me to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. Senator Arp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Anderson. I'm not a big fan of the JobZ program. You probably know that, and I'm skeptical of the Green JobZ program. But I have to say, I think there's a structural flaw in your bill, and that's that the local governments aren't participating. And so there, it looks like there's one particular plant in St. Paul that's going to get all kinds of state benefits, where we have those same concerns in other areas across the state. When I first started here, we lost the Totino plant and the Oak Grove Dairy in one town in my district. 400 jobs gone. We don't qualify for JobZ. We're at a great disadvantage. And in your bill, the commissioner of the Department of Economic Development is the sole decision maker about where these subsidies go. And so I think that's a structural issue. I prefer the system, I think, in the next bill that we'll hear has at least the local involvement and the local subsidies so that there's a partnership between the local and the state, and it's not just the state handing out tax benefits to businesses on a pick-and-choose, win-or-lose basis. I think it creates an additional problem with what we're trying to do here, which is incentives that get targeted, and so many areas of the state lose out again because they just don't get the same level of focus.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I would think that, well, certainly any facility in your community would be eligible. If it was a shutdown manufacturing facility or a formerly used site, industrial site that's been closed down, it would be eligible under this bill. It's statewide. And it is targeted to manufacturing jobs, which are the best paying jobs. Also, I think in terms of local involvement, there's no doubt in my mind that if any of these benefits were utilized by a company, that the local government would be involved and certainly would be needing to participate, probably with infrastructure improvements or other things. I just am resistant to us dictating what that there should be a property tax reduction, contribution. I think that decision should be made more at the local level. But we could certainly require local participation. I just think that the local government should determine how that is done.
Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, what I'm concerned about is a commissioner, not necessarily the particular current commissioner, but a commissioner, obviously is going to be more concerned about a plant with 400 jobs lost than the small plant in Norwood Young America with 15 jobs lost. But those 15 jobs in Norwood Young America are really important. And so the local community being involved here brings it to a higher level. They're putting their financing at stake. They create a partnership with the state, and they understand the impact. But I'm concerned that what this ends up doing is creating more opportunities for big plants and no opportunities for the small ones in greater Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's certainly not written to have that impact, and I totally agree with what your priorities that you're stating. I think that's what I'm trying to accomplish as well. So if you see a way that this bill doesn't accomplish that, I'm very open to adjusting it, because I agree with you that these opportunities are needed around the state in different communities.
And Senator Anderson, if this bill is to move forward this year, we'll work with Senator Artman and you and try to come up with some local component requirement. Any other questions, members? Anybody else want to testify on Senate File 1232? Senator Wong.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Anderson, and to your witnesses, I'm just grateful that there are ideas being floated out there. I was recently on a program in China, and I noticed that almost like in every single family home, there was a solar unit on the top of the roof that was collecting water every single home. And when I came back, I did a little bit of research on the internet to see if I could put a unit on the top of my roof. And it was pretty cost prohibitive to consider that. And I think that as part of some of the, what we're trying to do is that if we could get some of the productions to be local, we could certainly get it to the point where it's the cost of an air conditioning unit. Boy, wouldn't that be something exciting to think about. So I would encourage you to continue to do this, to move in that direction. That being said, I'm interested, as you move forward this effort, in looking at the subsidy agreements to see if there would be further contemplation to make sure that we put into there labor force recruitment efforts and disadvantaged business provisions to make sure that as we are moving forward to engage in these type of efforts, that we are paying attention to the kind of labor force that we're wanting to bring into the work that we're providing with government dollars. Because oftentimes when these type of efforts move forward, entire populations get left behind in the jobs that we create. And so I would appreciate, and I know that Senator Anderson, you are paying attention to that, but I would be interested in working with you on moving that forward.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I could respond briefly. Senator Ma, I really appreciate your comments, and I have to say, after this, I'm going upstairs to pass the stimulus bill with the energy dollars that in the Finance Committee that, number one, is going to put a lot of opportunities on the table for people like you and me to be able to afford a solar installation and for schools to do it around the state and public buildings as well as energy efficiency. There's a lot of federal dollars to help with that. And the solar industry in particular, if you look at the charts, the production is going up like this and the costs are going down like this every year. And so it's really, we're at that critical point in time when the industry is exploding and the costs are going to drop and it's going to become available, more widely available. And so now is the time, if we want to establish leadership as a state, we have to act now because a lot of other states are jumping into that field. And the stimulus bill, we spent a lot of time talking about that, the opportunities for green jobs and how they're an opportunity to really revitalize not just our state's economy, but workforce opportunities for all of our people. And so we've really tried to put that concept into that stimulus bill, and that's a very good suggestion. We need to make sure that that is comes forth in all of these green jobs efforts. But I think this is one of the ways that we could really target our efforts to create jobs in a tough economic time. So I hope members will give it consideration. I'd be happy to work with members on any modifications.
Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Henkel wants to say something.
Do you have something, Mr. Henkel?
I just wanted to compliment what Senator Anderson just said and add to that the fact that we're on the threshold in Minnesota of creating a significant cluster of economic activity, and I'm delighted that you brought it up, Senator, because it is precisely in the solar space that we have that opportunity. I think it's not been clear to people until recently that there's a significant supply chain for both solar thermal and solar PV in this state. And while I spoke earlier about the importance of this bill in relationship to the Ford site, it's a critical point for us to incentivize with a suite of development tools. And this is just one. I think it's important to recognize that this is not the only tool that's being discussed in this session for incentivizing startup and expanding green businesses in this state. One of those critical areas would be the solar PV manufacturing, solar thermal manufacturing, and it would be exponential growth. You know, we're not just talking about a one-off, but the ability to create significant multiplier effects, not only with the direct jobs that would be created, but because of the supply chain that would be affected in both of those areas, significant indirect and induced jobs as well. So we're talking about a significant development, a significant stimulative effect in this state.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Anderson. Chair lays over 1232 for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Rosen. Continued discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 1062.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And for the record, I didn't dress this way because of the Green Jobs Bill. I kind of noticed the green when I was driving here.
Chair, all three of them are dressed
apparently
in green.
Senator Ortman and Senator Blumer did. So.
Wow.
Well, I do have the Green Jobs Investment Initiative, or the Green Jobs E, and it's focusing and utilizing the Minnesota resources that we already have in place to develop clean and green technology, which will not only help us get to our 25% renewable energy standard, it's also going to create jobs. DEED sees a solid influx of inquiries dealing with clean and green technology over and over and over again. And they actually have, I believe, 53 projects in the pipeline that are inquiries about it. And actually, when you look at the political and the public and the investment area, they are all asking about clean and green technology, too. So it's really important to capitalize on something that we already have in place in the state. And Senate File 1062 is, I'll just briefly go over the bill as far as the articles. Article 1 is the language on the green jobs. Article 2 is a statewide green jobs, Article 1 is a statewide green jobs exemption. Article 2 is a small business investment tax credit, or the CAPCO. Article 3 is the angel tax credit. And Article 4 is the biomethane energy, which would help the utilities reach their 1.5% goal for conservation improvement programs. And it would utilize and focus on anaerobic digestion, gasification, and solar. So those are the four articles in the bill. So if I could briefly just go through Article 1, and Mr. Chair and members, you do have the revenue sheet in front of you for that. It would create a tax-free zone for renewable and clean energy businesses. It virtually would have the same tax exemptions as the original Jobs E, but with key differences, because we did listen and learn from not only your comments, but from the state auditor. Will statutorily require the project to seek deeds approval to receive green job benefits, will be available anywhere in the state, will not permit relocations within the state, and will give a business a full 12 years if the agreement is signed by December of 2015. And the definition of a green jobs, that's kind of one of the questions that always comes up. A job is a job, and I think that's been said by Senator Anderson, is our definition of the green jobs came out of the Green Job Task Force, and they should be focused on green products, renewable energy, green services, and environmental conservation. And like I said, Mr. Chair and members, we took the recommendations from the state auditor very, very seriously, and I think you'll notice that the language is tightly crafted to deal with those issues. The exemptions for green jobs include individual income tax, corporate franchise tax, the state sales and use tax, and a local sales and use tax, property tax. There's a wind energy production tax. And it would also provide a job credit against income tax for creating a high-paying job of over $37,000. And I just would like to briefly refer to, and I think Senator Anderson's done a wonderful job, and she was actually, I think, quoted in Profile, Politics in Minnesota, as she was green before green was cool, you know. And so she's done a tremendous work in this area. But I would like to just point out a couple differences in her bill versus the bill that's before you. Find my sheets here. And one is that she does not have a wind production tax. She does not have property tax in the bill. She also limits businesses to manufacturing of products that reduce environmental impact and increases efficiency, or manufacturers of motor vehicles with superior fuel economy. And she limits where the projects can occur to locations such as brownfields, the vacant buildings, or the Ford plant site. And also, and I think Senator Ortman brought this up very well, is that she does not include the deeds review and approval of projects, and I think that's a very important component of this. Article 2 is the CAPCO, or the Small Business Investment Company Credit. And I have an amendment, Mr. Chair and members, that would deal with Article 2 and 3. Article 2 is the CAPCO, and the Article 3 is the Angel Tax Credit.
We'll pass the amendment out.
If I could explain the amendment?
Sure.
Okay.
Senator Rosen.
The amendment is the A09-0385. So on the amendment, lines 1.2 and 1.4 deal with the CAPCO, or the Small Business Investment, and it deals with the filing application fee of $7,500 and the annual certification fee of $5,000. We'd like to have that designated into a special revenue fund. And lines 1.6 and 1.8 deal with another filing application fee for the Angel tax credit of $1,250, and lines 1.8, a fee of $250 for the certification as a qualified individual investor, and those would also be put into a special revenue account.
And Senator Rosen, what's the purpose of this, the special revenue fund? Is there tracking, or do they have some use that they're going to use for the money, or what's the purpose?
I have Mark Loftus here from Deed, and he could probably further explain, but I just think to keep it separate from all
Mr.
the other.
Loftus is
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Loftus. I'm with Deed. The purpose, Chairman and members, is that as we structured the original bill's language, it charges those fees for application and recertification, but it did not put it into a special revenue fund that would allow us to use those funds for staffing costs to administer the program. So as written currently, it would take that money and put it into the general fund, which was not the intent. It was to help us underwrite the costs of running the program.
Senator Ortman moves the 0385 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And then Article 2 is the Small Business Investment Company Credit. It would create a $63 million capital pool for investing in qualified small, emerging, and green businesses with a 60% tax credit for insurance companies for investing in the small business investment companies that are making the targeted investments. This program is $38 million total, and so it's $9.5 million per year over 4 years with a three-year waiting period. And there is stipulation that 50% of the funding must go to green technology and the rest would go to other technology-based. And then, again, there is an application fee in here of $7,500 and an annual certification fee of $5,000. And we all know, you're all very familiar with this as far as why it's important to have some kind of tool here. I thought Senator Saltzman was going to be having her bill up today that deals similar to the CAPCOs and the Angel tax credits, but you see that she pulled it.
It's tomorrow, Senator.
It's tomorrow. Okay. So in Article 2 and Article 3, we're targeting at companies that are less than 100 employees, and a minimum of 51% of the employees must be Minnesota, and they must be headquartered in Minnesota. Article 3 is the Job Growth Investment Tax Credit. And I'm sure you're all very familiar with that, too. A shortage of early-stage venture capital in Minnesota continues to be a problem. And this is a $12 million program with a $4 million for 3 years after a three-year holding period. It's a 25% tax credit for investing in targeted small emerging technology or green businesses by regional investment funds or individual investments. So it's a $48 million. It will generate $48 million in new investment. The maximum credit per individual is $100,000. The maximum credit per fund is $500,000. And the minimum investment per investor is $25,000. And with that, and then we have the Article 4, which is the biomethane energy, which we dealt with in Energy Committee. I have with me...
Senator Rosen, the biomethane energy is new to me. Do you want to just walk us briefly through that?
Sure. Certainly. As I mentioned, it's basically... it's promoting small-scale renewable energy products that will help those utilities, because right now they aren't able to take into account for their CIP program, the Conservation Improvement Program, that they have to meet at 1.5%. They can't take in gasification or the anaerobic digestion and solar. So we're trying to increase that and promote that.
And what's the incentive offered to these companies?
Well, in the solar, we're increasing the qualifying solar electric project from 100 to 200 kilowatts. And the It just basically helps them meet their goal in those areas of biomethane. We want the utilities to meet this SIP goal.
Okay. Senator Dibble?
The idea, I mean, I'm just reading it now, but the incentive is exactly as Senator Rosen described. You know, the natural gas utilities have the same goals as electrical utilities, which is to save 1.5% of their energy sales year over year. The natural gas utilities are finding that goal a little more difficult than the electrical utilities because of the nature of natural gas is vastly different than electricity. Natural gas is used only for specific applications, particularly in a residential setting. So an idea that has come up is to think of distributed and alternative energy as a form of conservation because it helps save from, we don't really have natural gas baseload, but, you know, from the traditional sources of natural gas, which is highly volatile product in terms of price. And, you know, like I said, is the conservation goal is much, much more difficult. You know, boilers, you know, some stoves, you know, some other applications, some dryers and the like use natural gas, but, you know, you don't flip on your lights and we don't have gas lights anymore and that sort of thing. So.
Thank you. Do you have testifiers, Senator Rolden?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Dibble. Explained it much, much better than I do. I have with me Mr. Chuck Hayes. He's the VP of Sage Electrochromics down in Faribault.
Mr. Hayes?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senate members. My name is Chuck Hayes. I am a vice president at Sage Electrochromics in Faribault, Minnesota, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak about something I'm real passionate about, and that's job creation. As means of introduction, Sage manufactures a green, clean, new energy conservation technology that's called electrochromic glass. This electronically tintable glass technology allows you to tint and clear glass on the exterior of a building, not just for solar glare control, but also for solar heat gain control. U.S. Department of Energy tested Sage glass through Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, and that testing showed that this technology, when installed in a building and integrated with the lighting systems and the heating and air conditioning systems, would reduce the overall energy consumption of a commercial building by up to 40%. So it's a very significant conservation technology development. And when you consider that commercial buildings account for over 40% of the energy consumption, all sources in the United States, that's a very significant conservation technology. Sage's experience with job creation has been a positive one, and I appreciate the skepticism in the room on Job Z, because I'm also a resident of the state and a taxpayer, and it's important that we examine these things. But I want to talk to you for a few minutes about a success story from Job Z. Sage did not incubate in Minnesota. Sage incubated in New Jersey at Rutgers University Center for Ceramic Research. That incubation started in 1989. In 1999, Sage moved from New Jersey to Minnesota because our founder and CEO, John Van Dyne, had identified Minnesota as what he called the Silicon Valley of the glass industry. The companies that created the current energy efficiency technology called Low-E glass were either headquartered here or in border states. That was a technology innovation back in the 1980s. But the companies who were most progressive in the architectural glass industry were here. The reason Sage moved here was to develop a pilot line to get the technology out of the lab and figure out how to scale it on a factory floor and actually produce this stuff. And in 2003, Sage was one of the first companies to sign on to the original Job Z program. At that time in 2003, we were a company of 23 people. With the help of JobZ, Sage was able to attract the private investment necessary to help us accelerate our transformation from a research company into a high technology manufacturing company. JobZ helped accelerate our job creation. It also helped accelerate our ability to deliver this energy conservation technology in volume to the marketplace. We started at 23 people. We made a commitment under JobZ to create at least 20 new jobs. And I was here a few weeks ago testifying, and I said then that I was a couple of jobs short of actually being able to report that we had tripled that job growth. We have, in fact, done that. We just in the last week hired 2 May graduates from engineering program at the University of Minnesota Mankato, and they'll be starting a week after graduation. So we're up to, I think, 86 employees, and we'll be at 88 employees within the next month. And I want to point out that those aren't minimum wage jobs. Those are living wage jobs. Some of them are professional. Quite a few of those jobs are living wage manufacturing jobs. And our manufacturing jobs, people aren't working so much these days in new technology manufacturing by the sweat of their brow. Those are knowledge worker jobs. Those are jobs we provide extra training. They need computer skills. They need problem-solving skills. And they pay better. And so those are all living wage jobs. They come with benefits, things like health care. And I think I have one of the best jobs in the state because I've had the ability over the last couple of years to actually do the hiring of most of those people. So I know people who are single moms who are on Minnesota health care who were underemployed and are now established on their own and off of public assistance of every kind. So I'm very passionate about this topic. As we're talking about building mechanisms to accelerate job growth, I really wish I could tell you that the private sector could do this on their own, but it just doesn't happen that way. Most new technologies incubated through a partnership that is really public and private. And most new technologies do not survive their incubation period. When you look at the computer industry, the transistor took 16 years of drudgery before they produced the first one. Sage started in 1989. We shipped our first commercial glass in February of 2006. 17 years. 17 years of basically burning money, burning working capital. So this stuff doesn't happen naturally or easily on its own. And in an environment where investors seem to all want their returns in 90 days or less, a 17-year incubation period is not very exciting. So a lot of the technology opportunities die along that path. Sage would not be shipping commercial glass without the assistance on a national level from the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense, the National Science Foundation, at the state level, from DEED, from various state agencies. We were stuck at the pilot line stage. We were working for 2 years to find private investment. I can't tell you it was all JobZ. I'd like to think it was some of our effort. But shortly after JobZ, we were able to follow through and line up investors. Programs such as Green JobZ will lower the cost of capital to expansion. They lower the risk of success to new incubating businesses. And for companies like Sage, that's a survival issue. And they help us attract the private investment. So I appreciate the time to speak to Senate File 1062. In our case, it was certainly a very worthy investment.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes. The question occurred earlier today with regard to when the JobZ benefits expire for your company. Can you talk just a little bit about what you see in the future?
We're quite a few years into it. I think there's 6 years left. A lot of energy gets talked around things like the income tax incentives, and I think one thing that is often lost in the discussion, especially when we're in an economic environment we're in now, is how enormously expensive it is to incubate new technology businesses. If we had hung up on income tax, there's no income. There's no income for a lot of years in a lot of these technology businesses. Things like property tax, yes, the local government needs to be very involved in that whole process, but things like property tax are much more critical to incubating new technology businesses. The provisions such as income tax become more important later on. They're very, very important provisions when you're trying to attract private investment, however, because they're taking much higher risk than if they just put their money into established business. Are there other specific things I could comment on there?
No, very good.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rosen, I appreciate the fact that you opened this up to everywhere in the state. That was my biggest bone of contention with the communities in those border areas, and Mr. Loftus has been out there to tour, as have members of the Senate. So I appreciate that, and the fact that we're not going to have businesses moving from community to community within the state. That was a really major objection on my part. I'm inclined to support something like this. I wanted to ask you about Article 2 and the reason you've included a 50% requirement for green jobs or green businesses in Article 2. I would think that we could open that up to any kind of investment, and I would feel a little more comfortable with that rather than there being a restriction or setting it as a goal that those investments be for, you know, that half of them be for green jobs. But to see it as a restrictor is uncomfortable for me. I'd like to think that they could use it for any type of investment in any new jobs.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, that's a very good argument, and I think the focus was on green and clean.
Yeah, I know it was a green bill, but
it's the green bill. And I think that's where we were thinking, hoping, too, that with the number of jobs that would be created, especially in Article 2, which would be about 1,500 jobs at an average wage of over $50,000, that we would attract that type of technology in. But I'm going to turn it over to Mark Loftus because it is the governor's bill and the deeds bill, and see what he says about that suggestion.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, it's as Senator Rosen said. In the discussion we heard with the previous bill was the same thrust, that there are companies across the country, and in fact across the world, with investment and job creation opportunities and growing businesses that are looking for locations in the green technology industry. If you look at Thomas Friedman's approach to the next century's economy, it's very much the United States can be a leader in the next economy if we focus on green and clean technology. So philosophically, one could argue with it, the percentage of 50% or the focus or the minimum threshold, but it was that intent that Minnesota wants to be part of the leadership of the next century's economy, and green and clean is one way. Not the only way, but perhaps one way.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Sir, Ortman.
I'm wondering if you would look at page 38. I don't disagree that this is a trend and that Minnesota should capitalize on the trend, but I'm not sure that we should set a quota then. I think that in this particular article, we've got Article 1 focused on green jobs, but Article 2, I would hope, would be an investment tool for anything. And if you could get 100% green, I wouldn't object to that. But I wouldn't want to put that restriction, because then you might have some non-green businesses that want to qualify and can't. And I don't want to do that either. So I'm wondering if you would be willing to support an amendment, Senator Rosen, to take out on line 38.33, after businesses at the end there, take out with at least 50% of the investments to be made in qualified green businesses. And then it can be either a business or a green business that qualifies, and there would be no restriction on the percentages.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
And Senator Ortman, that would be fine with me and the department.
Mr. Chair, I would make that motion.
Senator Ortman moves the oral amendment on line 38.33, delete with, and 38.34, delete everything before subject.
The comma.
comma after businesses on line 38.34. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senator Rosen?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just make a comment to what is happening out there as far as the competition. The competition, not only national, but our immediate concern is just around the corner. And the Job Z bill last, the previous Job Z, as you well know, as the author, did not include the angel tax credit or the capital of the small business investment credit. And that's an important component of this green jobs bill. Yesterday, it looks like Wisconsin, I don't know if you saw that, increased their credits for angel investors from $5.5 million to $18.25 million, and increased the credits available for venture investors from $6 million to $18.75 million, increases the aggregate cap of credits available to a single angel investor from $1 million to $4 million, and increase the aggregate cap of credits available to any business from $4 million to $8 million. So the competition is right next door in this arena. And they've also, you know, as you know, Wisconsin's done a very good job previously as far as in the bioscience and job creation. And I would, well, anybody that sits with me in energy or jobs committee knows that how I feel about Iowa, and I hope I don't offend anybody here. I live 8 miles from the Iowa border, and they're frankly kicking us around. They have this Iowa, it's called the Iowa Value Fund, and right now it's $38 million a year that they invest. It's with no legislative authority. It's forgivable loans. It's grants. And frankly, you get out there and you start talking to people that are dealing with attracting businesses into the state, and we are getting the leftovers, unfortunately, when it comes to green technology or clean technology. They are flocking to Iowa. And I guess I can't do my Iowa jokes anymore because IBM just expanded down there in Dubuque. Hormel just expanded in Dubuque. They've got 6 of the wind turbine manufacturers, one just right across the border from me. And they have a very aggressive approach to a resource, and that's renewables / agriculture. So it makes sense to me. There is a project that hopefully is going to go in Grand Rapids, and the startup company manufactures wind turbines that they use for their own use in U.S., Asia, China, and India, and they would be 2 megawatt turbines. They need port access. It would be a $53 million startup cost with 250 jobs in 4 years. And the building site in Grand Rapids is ideal, but they need the incentives because they are getting courted very strongly around. So we need something to at least bring people in so we have at least the discussion. And that's what we need. We need the discussion about why should you invest in Minnesota.
Senator Rosen, I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to take the bait. Minnesota has a huge jobs problem, and you probably weren't here earlier when I said this tax bill is going to have two components to it. One is it's going to balance the budget, but the second one is it's going to spend a significant amount of money on economic development and try to grow some jobs in this state. Now, the press is already writing the story about the tax increase, but there's going to be another piece in this bill. But the problem, Senator Rosen, is here's where I'm going to get into trouble. Under Governor Plenty's leadership, the state's going backwards on the jobs front. You cannot do these kind of economic development incentive plans unless you have money to spend. We have no money to spend. You know, I mean, I went and looked on Deed's website, and under Governor Perpich, the state created 35,000 jobs a year, and under Governor Carlson, 42,000 jobs a year, and under Governor Ventura, 23,000 jobs a year. I will bet anybody in this room that wants to bet $100 that under Governor Plenty, at the end of 8 years, the state is going to have negative jobs. There are going to be less jobs in Minnesota at the end of his term than there was at the beginning. I mean, forget about the fact, about the annual fact, that those governors all grew jobs on an annual basis. I'm talking about a governor after 8 years that's going to have less people working in the state than when he was first elected. So we're going to spend some money on jobs in this bill, but I'm going to be perfectly honest with everybody on the Senate floor. We have to raise some revenue to do that. And I'm going to get all kicked around when we roll out a tax bill with a tax increase in it, but the fact of life is if we're going to turn this state around and put people to work, it's going to take programs like this. And they're going to cost real money to compete with Wisconsin and with Iowa and with other states that are putting incentives out there. It takes money to do that. So now I'm going to get off the soapbox. I'll probably get a call from the governor, but all it is the truth. You know, we're going to have less people working in Minnesota than we did 8 years ago. And shame on all of us for letting that happen.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to ask Senator Rosen how Iowa can afford to do that or what it is about Iowa that makes it possible for them. You know, it's not the forests and the trees and the lakes and, you know, the great fishing or even the sports teams.
The twins.
Or, you know, what is it? Where are they getting the money for that?
Senator Scheid, that's a very good question, and unfortunately I live with that all the time. They have rolled out a welcoming mat. They understand what their strong points are, and frankly, green and clean technology is a form of agriculture, just like forest products is, and biofuels, and go on and on. So they have focused in on that sector, and they are truly making a difference. It was sink or swim for Iowa because there is nothing to keep the young folks there. They're all heading to Omaha and Minneapolis and maybe Des Moines, but they have focused in, and they when I know when Hormel went down there to open their plant in Dubuque, they had over 200 people there at the grand opening, government officials, and really made a big deal about these jobs. I think that's a component that we need to work on instead of passing legislation that keeps hammering at job creation and business owners and the business climate. It's not one single issue in Minnesota, but it's a combination of a lot of things that have made Minnesota maybe not as friendly to the business climate. So they tend to look someplace else. It's certainly not our good looks that they come here.
Well.
But maybe you're Senator Scheid, but they've really focused in on their known resource, and that's renewables and our clean green technology.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. First of all, do you always get a call from the governor when you complain about him? I complain about him all the time, never get a call.
Senator Dibble, the governor's people watch room 15.
Well, I'll start complaining in this room then. No. I'd like a call from the governor. Anyways, actually, I've had some good conversations with the governor this year on some different things. But I was just going to actually agree with Senator Rosen, and I think she just did a nice job of talking about what Iowa does, that they're doing better than Minnesota is. You know, there's the great story about Governor Vilsack and now the current governor who's actually gone to these trade shows and these industry shows and planted himself for 2+ days at the Iowa booth to pitch entrepreneurs and to pitch this industry sector and coming to Iowa, personally spent his time there. So what Iowa's done is they've established a fairly coherent and comprehensive economic development strategy that takes into account that piece, you know, the kind of the marketing and really presenting Iowa to these industry sector, but also, you know, have the ability to back it up with, aligning their investments in training and research, workforce development, their infrastructure, you know, identifying exactly what they're going for and making sure that they're putting the supply and the service chain into place, those sorts of things. So it's about targeting and focusing the resources and the investment, the infrastructure, and then providing some incentives, as Senator Rosen is seeking to do, and Senator Rosen and I have had a discussion about some of the regulatory hurdles that we learned about through the Green Jobs Task Force, where a number of folks in Minnesota who are trying to make a go of things don't argue with our environmental standards. They argue with how we get there, how long it takes, how there's not a clear process with a clear timeline, and forced to hire untold number of consultants and spend millions and millions of dollars. Oh, and things get changed midstream, and we've got to hire some more consultants, that sort of thing. And Iowa has managed to break through a lot of those and really line up all of those systems and priorities and resources. And they've succeeded. Six manufacturers in the turbine industry, Iowa. We've got arguably some of the best renewable energy and energy efficiency policies on the books and some of the best resources. We should have those manufacturers here.
Yep.
Senator, well, I'm working on an amendment for the Environment Finance Bill to get at this environmental review process, and because we do have a big problem. And when I had dinner with the governor about 6 weeks ago, I raised this issue with him. I said, you know, Governor, it's not all about taxes. We have other problems in our business development climate. So I'm going to work on an amendment to put in the Environment Finance Bill that asks the Pollution Control Agency to do a study and come back with some recommendations where we can streamline that review process. I was incredibly disappointed at the Ranger Party. U.S. Steel came in from Pittsburgh, and they came to me, and I asked them how the permitting was going on their expansion at Keewatin. They want to add another line at Keewatin to their mine there. All the environmental impacts we know about, I mean, it is simply an expansion of the existing mine. There is nothing new. It's a $700 million economic development project. They're about a year into the permitting, and the DNR is already 4 months behind. Now, something's wrong with this system. There's nothing new to identify. There's an existing mine there. We know what all the impacts are. And even when it's like that, and even when U.S. Steel agrees that it's going to take 18 months under the Minnesota regulatory process to get the permit, we've already slipped 4 months behind. We wonder why we can't get any investment here. We have some huge challenges in Minnesota relative to our regulatory climate also, and I'm the last person that wants to compromise on the environment. I live up north. The reason I live up there is I love the environment that it allows me to live in. But there ought to be some way that when we tell a company that wants to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in your state, and we know what all the impacts are, we shouldn't have already slipped 4 months behind. And I'm very troubled by that. So Senator Rosen, and I've expressed this to the governor personally, that our problem is more than about just our tax climate. And creating incentives like this is not enough. There's other obstacles in the way to create economic development in Minnesota, and we got to start to have a discussion about what they are and figure out how we can streamline the process. If we all want to get to the end, let's figure out how we can get there a little quicker, or at a minimum, let's get there on time, which we're not able to do today for some reason. But we all got to figure that out. So I'm going to be asking Senator Anderson to put a provision, Senator Dibble, in the bill that has PCA come to us with some recommendations so we can shorten that time frame some and at least deliver on time.
Well, Mr. Chair, I hope they come forward with some requests for resources too. I mean, I think part of the problem is PCA is just, you know, they just get behind because they're bogged down and they won't ask for what they need to get their job done. But clearly, too, I mean, there's some problem with the process, and we learned that in some fairly stark detail as we talked to some of these really great companies who, like I said, have no problem with the environmental standards. It's right. The how you figure out as you get to the permit.
Right. And Mr.
Senator Rosen?
And to that point, I mean, excellent comments. I believe a one-stop shop would be wonderful for these companies that want to come through, and instead of trying to mitigate and go through all these different departments, if you could just get help and you have a timeline and they stay to it, and all the departments stick to it. I mean, I have some horror stories, and I know how some of you feel about the ethanol industry, but there are companies that will never develop in the biofuels industry in Minnesota again because of their horror stories, and that happened several years ago. We're missing out on a cellulosic ethanol plant is being built right across the border in Iowa. Another $170 million from the feds to go to this plant because POET, or Broin, they used to be, had such a horrible experience in Minnesota trying to build the first 100-million-gallon ethanol plant. and it was the DNR, and it was the PCA, and it was just over and over retesting. And we have to stop that. I mean, we have to make sure that we adhere to our environmental priorities, but we also cannot keep shutting the door on these people, and that's what's happened. So maybe a one-stop shop. We all know that job creation is what's going to get us out of this. Unfortunately, ever since I've been in the legislature, we've started out with a $4.2 billion deficit, and it's just been spiraling down since then.
Senator Rosen, you weren't here for the good old days. When I came here in 95, and Senator Ress was the chair of the tax committee then, we cut taxes for my first 7 years here. Every year we cut taxes. We gave 20% rebates on your property taxes. Most people remember the Jesse checks. We did the school takeover, two different rounds of income tax cuts. And now today, the people that were here, including the governor, are unwilling to say, you know what, the pendulum swung too far. And when the economy was really at its pinnacle and we were making all those cuts, and there were people voted against some of them, the 2001 takeover, the 2001 tax bill, I think Senator Pogemiller voted against it. He was the chair of the committee. Senator Doug Johnson, who had been a 20-year chair of this committee, voted against that tax bill. Senator Moe voted against it. And all said this isn't sustainable. And somehow today, we don't seem to have the courage, I think, to admit that all those cuts we made weren't sustainable in the long run. So, Senator Rosen, you're right. We've had nothing but problems since you came here, and those of us that were here before, those of you that were here before, plenty of us at this table, including the governor, when times were good, we overcommitted. And now we don't have money to do the things we need to do to try and grow our economy.
Mr. Chair, I would like to say, though, there is a the annual convention for I'm going to turn over to Mark.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senator
Scoy's got a question.
Yeah,
before we go on, if we're going to do something on this environmental review, and I've heard discussion about that here, I actually carried a bill a couple years ago to work with the departments on streamlining their permitting process for Minnesota. Part of the problem, and people need to understand this, is Minnesota does their permitting differently than the surrounding states. We require the building permit and the operational permit before you start. Other states issue the building permit. Then while you're in the building phase, they work through the issues of the operational permits, which shortens it up. And it's just a functional difference. And if people are going to work on that, that's probably where you might want to think about targeting your efforts.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Dibble's question about marketing the state and how effectively Minnesota can compete is a good question, and we've been out in the marketplace. We've been at the wind energy show. We've been at the biotechnology show, trade shows. In fact, May 4th through the 7th, we'll be in Chicago at the American Wind Energy Association show I believe, at least 40 Minnesota people, individuals, companies, investors, with a nice pavilion that Minnesota will be at. We've invited the governor. We don't know if he can make it. He's been at other events like our biotech show in the past. But when we go to those shows, we are competing with the other states. They all have the big pavilion and the presence that you need to have in an event like that. And we found that something like a Jobsy incentive is a real eye-catching thing. And before you came back, Senator Bach, there was a discussion about why not just use the current Jobsy program. Why do we need green Jobsy? Because it's the same tax exemptions. Well, Senator Scoy, my answer to that is that with the green Jobsy, we have a full 12 years of benefits available through any agreement signed by the end of 2015 would have full 12 years after that. So with the current Jobsy at 2015, everything expires. We signed a deal today. It expires December of 2015. So the window is shrinking with the existing Jobsy. That's why we recommended the green Jobsy to replace that and actually override that in terms of the benefit.
Well, Mr. Chair, but we could just, institute the Jobsy program that we currently have so it has 12 years. mean, that would be the same effect. That's to Senator Artman's point about why do we target just these certain companies to the detriment of somebody else who comes along, because as everybody says, a good job is a good job.
Mr. Chairman, that, and Senator Scoia, that is true. We could do that. I think with our green proposal, we tried to be more selective. As you saw, the revenue note impact, we have a smaller number of jobs coming in each year than we had under the original Jobs E, because it's more selective in terms of the companies. So I think we were trying to be more selective in our whole new approach of overseeing the program.
Senator Scoia.
And Mr. Chair, one other thing. I heard this earlier this session somewhere else, but it was alluded to today by one of Senator Anderson's testifiers, and that's this large percentage of the renewable energy industry that's outside of Minnesota. I think I heard 93%. So we passed this mandate on, so our ratepayers are going to pay more for electricity and probably natural gas, and all the benefit is going outside of the state. At the same time, we had a pretty robust Jobs E program. So there's something wrong with what we're doing there. And I don't think it's the mandate or the tax policy. I think it's something else. And we need to figure out what that something else is, because a couple of years ago when we passed the renewable energy requirement, I mean, Jobs E had 8 years or 10 years or whatever it had at that point, and those companies still didn't build here. 94% of the money that Minnesotans are spending for the renewable energy is going to companies outside of our state. It's unbelievable.
Senator Rosen,
and
Senator Rosen, I met with a company recently that's interested in building a wind-type manufacturing business in Minnesota.
In Grand Rapids.
And I mentioned the idea of tax credits to him. He said, I'm not interested. He said, tax credits only help you if you're making money. And he said, we don't anticipate in the early years that we're going to make any money. He said, so I'd rather not talk about tax credits. He wants help with
cash.
Development costs.
Yes, cash.
The development costs of the project. The capital equipment. And, you know, Senator Rosen, I'd like to raise enough money so that we could do the upfront exemption on capital equipment in this bill. It would reduce the cost of capital by 6.5%. Right, day one, when the governor signs it into law, the cost of capital is going to go down 6.5% in Minnesota. But, Senator Rosen, the problem is I have to have $80 million to do that. And we find ourselves trying to do economic development with one hand tied behind our back in Minnesota. That's why we're losing. We're losing. We should have done the upfront capital exemption years ago. But we've never had any money to do it. We all agree it's the right thing to do, but some of us are unwilling to put any money on the table so that we can pay for it. And that's going to be the other piece of the tax bill, Senator Senjum. And I'm going to get my head absolutely lopped off, I'm sure, by the governor and on the floor about the tax increase in the bill. But we're going to have some job creation pieces in this bill to try and put Minnesota back to work. And we're going to be honest with people, and we're going to pay for them, because there's no other way to do them. We just can't invent the cash and do the upfront exemption. We have to generate the cash in the bill to pay for it. So I'm actually looking forward to the discussion about that, if people care about trying to do something about economic development or not, because you can't do it without money. And I think that's one of the big problems we have right now, is we're unwilling to commit the resources to get the job done. And, I mean, we've had, and maybe the tax committee's got advantages over some of the other committees, but, I mean, the state economist sat in that chair not that many weeks ago and said, you are not going to grow your way out of this budget problem that Minnesota has. It's not going to happen. Not going to happen. And so I think we've got some huge challenges, but we need to get the one hand that's behind the back out on the table here and put two hands to work before we're going to skin this problem and it's about more than just, I think Senator Scoy's right, it's about more than just tax policy. There's something else wrong in Minnesota. I'm not sure any of us at this table know what it is, but we need to all collectively try to figure it out if we're going to compete out there. Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you're going along all these paths, I'd like to interject one thing that Senator Dibble alluded to. When Iowa and these other states have streamlined their package to get these businesses on board, one thing is they've marketed it well with everybody on the same message. And we tend to say things like what you just said. I mean, we're fighting against each other about what is wrong here. Let's market ourselves as a formulated package, a system that they can look at and work through, no different than their five-year business plan. And if we can all get on the same message and market ourselves correctly, I think with the incentives, with whatever other program we come up with, I think if we all message it the same, we can do it right.
You know, Senator Rosen, one of the things I'm troubled about is when people come to the table in this committee and influential people in Minnesota, in the business community, and frankly some in the administration, come to the table and say, what a terrible place Minnesota is to do business. This is just a terrible place to do business. People come there all the time and talk about that. We're not people from the business community, not trying to market our state, come here and trash our state at that table about what a terrible place this is. You know, when I had the opportunity to tour Medtronic, right, the first week of the session, and I learned a lot about what's going on in the development of medical devices in the world, and I found out that almost all the medical device development that's being done in the world is being done in Minnesota. And that started developing here after World War II, and it didn't happen here because this was a low-tax state. It happened here because we had a workforce that it made sense to do it here. And it made sense to move beyond Medtronic to other companies doing it here. And it didn't happen. We had a CI tax rate of back in those early development years of 5.6% probably on property, in a upper tier on the income tax at, 17% in Minnesota at one time. But that industry developed here, and it's happening here like no place else in the world. And I just think it's very, very frustrating when we hear people in the business community and others come in here and say what a terrible place this is to do business. I don't believe it. I think Minnesota has some huge advantages over Iowa and South Dakota and over Wisconsin. But we don't talk about them. We just talk about what's wrong in Minnesota. And so I think we all need to think about that and start talking about the reason that Minnesota is a good investment. And because I think if we actually get down to the heart of it, I think we all agree that that's true, that this is a good place to develop and grow a business. And we want Minnesota to be successful, but we aren't doing a very good job of communicating it. Senator Ortman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say thank you. Hopefully everybody agrees that this is a good proposal and one that we should be putting forward, and so I would just move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Are we done with it? Because I kind of got here halfway through. Senator Rosen, have we gone through it completely?
Yes, and thank you, Senator Ortman. I think it's very good. Unless you have any other questions or anybody else.
Well, Mr. Chair, we've spent a lot of discussion on the green jobs part, but there are three other articles to this bill,
right.
And I think that the tax committee needs to pay some particular attention to those because they are important jobs creation, the rain and the venture capital, and then also that energy part. So
I think, Senator Scoy, we have other bills that are similar to the articles that we're going to hear tomorrow. So we're not done with this jobs discussion by far. Senator Saltzman, I think, has a bill that's same as one of these, or very similar to one of these articles?
Mr. Senator Chair Rosen? And Senator Scott, it's very similar, but ours is $38 million. Hers is on the small business investment is, I mean, there are some differences as far as number of employees, but hers is $160 million, Senator Saltzman, for the small business investment.
And Senator Rosen, how much is yours?
$38 million.
Who has a better bill?
Well, I'm on both. Mr. Chair. Because, Mr. Chair and members, she's taking a look at the entire biotechnology industry also with this small business investment bill and her angel tax and credit. So, and you're very familiar with that. I mean, right from the get-go, and you've been a part of it. So, I think the issue is that we get something going in these jobs, and we include all these type of investments. And the angel, she's I don't know where it's at. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't have that information in front of me.
Senator Rosen, when and I'm not sure if it was when Revenue was in here presenting the governor's bill or if it was actually in my office when a discussion with, and I'm not sure if it was people with the administration or people in the Department of Revenue, I asked the question about why the governor's proposal on that Saltzman bill, the insurance company investment bill,
mm-hmm.
why the governor's number was so small. And I think he offered a 60% tax credit. No other state has been less than 100, I understand, but he's in at 60. And so I asked the question, why is it a pared-down version? And Senator Rosen, you know what I was told?
What?
They didn't have enough money. So apparently it's not a priority. And I think that's why we're struggling, is that job creation is not a priority. Somehow managing, we think it's a good idea, but we're only willing to do it to the extent that we can cobble together a few nickels. If it was really important, let's do it in a big way and create some jobs. But that's why apparently the governor's number is as small as it is. They didn't have enough money to do anything more than that. And I just would argue what that tells me is, well, I guess then it's not a priority. Other things were more important than the jobs component. Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd go back to one of your early comments. All of these economic development innovations are all well and good, but if we could do just one thing, it would be to get rid of the refund on the capital equipment. That takes one line drawing through or one little repealer, and I would maintain that that would do more to get us moving forward, not only as a permanent policy, but also as a stimulative one. And all these other things sound great to me, but if you line them all up, I mean every single one, Rosen bill, the Anderson bill, all other kinds of even the income tax credits for all good causes, and put that against the capital equipment exemption, hands down is where I'd go, right there to that. Get rid of it once and for all, and then it's done, and we'd never have to revisit it. And then we could worry about whether we're going to have enough money to do this little program at 30% or this one at 60% or whether we really want to deal with, as you indicated, that one company that you talked to, whether they need income tax credits at all. If they don't make any money, the incubator that was there for 17 years, they didn't pay any income tax. That's not what was going to be helping them unless you make it a refundable credit, and we can't afford those.
Right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Moy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, I would compliment you the same way I did to Senator Anderson. I think it's really exciting to have you and Senator Anderson and Senator Saltzman and Senator Olson, I mean, bringing these really great ideas forward, and I think it's the right time, and it's exciting. And so we don't have all the money in the world to do this, but you know what? Great ideas have to take shape and get planted somewhere. And I really like the innovative thinking that's going on here. And so, you know, I don't know to what degree we'll be able to do with all these great ideas, but there is tremendous value to putting them out there and to getting us to start thinking about it and, you know, getting creative suggestions on what else we could do with the larger system to move in this direction. So I want to compliment you for putting this together, and I think it's really great. I would also then give you the same comment, though, that as we look at the business subsidy agreements and the report back, that we pay careful attention to, again, if we're, it's about creating jobs, it's about developing our workforce, it's about giving Minnesotans an opportunity to get to the jobs that need that they need, then we should pay careful attention to make sure that the criteria we're putting in place for the report back is disaggregated and that we do get meaningful information about who's getting these jobs and how we're getting people to these jobs and what kind of training do they need in order to get to these jobs. Because at the end of the day, we can do all of this, but if we don't have meaningful information about how people are being able to benefit from what we're paying for in terms of jobs, at what level of pay, and whether or not it's making a difference in their lives, I think then it defeats the purpose of us trying to be creative. So as we move forward with these ideas, I hope that you will be open to a conversation about that.
Mr. Chair. To the point, Senator, I thank you very much, and I think we've learned a lot, like I said, from the job seat discussion and some of the hiccups that we had with it. And I believe having that workforce element and the training and having MNSCQ on board and making sure that we are developing training programs specifically to address these issues is really critical. I wish there was a single bullet that we could say this is the problem in Minnesota as far as our business climate, because, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if you asked Medtronics, are they developing and are they expanding in Minnesota, or is some of their expansion going out of the state? And that's what I'm very concerned about, is that we do have the IP, the intellectual property here. We do have some wonderful businesses, but why do they look at other states? Why won't they expand in the state? So it's not only attracting companies here, it's the retention and the expansion that I'm very concerned about, and you know that. So I think it's just a whole plethora of issues that it's one after another, and we just need to send a signal that we are interested, we need your jobs, and we will develop our workforce, and we will do whatever we can to keep you here.
Senator Rosen, it starts by making job creation a priority. And I know it is for you, and I admire that about you. And we need it to be a priority for more members of the legislature. And when enough of us care about it, it won't matter who the governor is. Won't matter. Because we'll do things in economic development, and it'll cost money, and we'll pay for it. When it's a priority for enough members around here, it'll happen, regardless of who the governor is. So I appreciate the huge effort, emphasis that you've given to the idea of trying to do something with job creation in Minnesota. Senator Whitman? Anything else, members? Senator Sundrum.
Mr. Chair, I probably, like you, probably shouldn't get too far into this, but maybe some night we find a little beverage and you find some of that pizza you were talking about a couple of weeks ago, and we really kind of go into the tunnel and talk this out, because I think you're absolutely right. We've got to get our hands on job creation in Minnesota. And while you may have your ideas, I would suggest that, for goodness sakes, if we're 41st in the country in overall business climate from a tax perspective, will we be better if we're 42? And I doubt that we will. But we got to talk about that and have that conversation and find the way. And I was on a city council for 11 years, in a kind of a medium-sized city, and we would have these people coming, in my case, to Rochester, and it's basically, what can you do for us? And we had, you know, maybe some TIF, that was about it, maybe a deed grant, that was unusual. But other than that, they were looking at Joliet and Minot and Cedar Rapids and other cities like that, and in many cases, that's where they went. So, you know, we're all on the same team. We're all pulling, the rope the same way. We all want the same end. It's kind of how to get there, and again, maybe we need to go out some night and have that conversation.
You know, Senator Sundrum, I carried a bill probably 3 years ago now. After LTV Mining Company shut down, we had an opportunity to build a new value-added iron nugget plant on that property, small little plant, a couple hundred million dollars, and we were in competition with Indiana for it, and some of you remember that, and Indiana committed that in 6 months they could get the environmental permits for the plant to be built. So we, with almost a unanimous vote in the Senate, waived that project from the environmental review process. First time it was ever done. First time. Because we didn't want, Minnesota didn't want that plant to go to Indiana. And so we didn't require an EIS. First time we've ever done it. You know, Senator Sundrum, it took 18 months to get the permit. 18 months when we waived the EIS process. Didn't even require an EIS. So there is something wrong with our process in Minnesota. Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right.
And, you know, this was a brownfield site that there had been for 50 years a huge taconite mine on. And still, even when no EIS was required, it took 18 months to get a permit. Now, fortunately, you know, that's where the iron ore is. And that's probably the only thing that holds these mining companies in this lengthy review process here, is this is where the resource is. Or we wouldn't have any of them here if we were depending on any kind of expedited environmental review process. So if that was expedited. I don't know if we had been out of the permitting process yet if we had required a full-blown EIS on it. But, Mr. Senator Sundrum, let me make you an offer.
All right.
The Tax Conference Committee in this room is going to spend a lot of time talking about jobs. And I don't know what the House is going to come with, but you know, one of their proposals that I've read about in the newspaper, and I haven't talked to Representative Mancheski about it, was to get rid of the research and development credit that we offer to Minnesota companies, to the Medtronics, the 3Ms of the world. You know, and they're going to save about $25 or $30 million a year by doing that. So they're going to bring jobs discussion to the table in the conference committee, I'm sure, if for no other reason, for the elimination of that tax credit. So, Senator Sundrum, Senator Rosen, I would love to have one of you two on the conference committee. And afterwards, I can tell you how you can get there. That little that little green button on that desk would show a lot of courage, and it would get you at the table here. Now, maybe you don't want to do that much work over the next month, but because it's going to require a lot of effort. But it is. Oh, you could get into that discussion, and maybe, and we'd even get some village pizza because you remember I had Senator Wieger promise that if we did the North St. Paul TIF thing, we'd get some village pizza for the conferees. Well, Representative Lilly must have been watching us on television because he actually came to me over in the Senate chamber and said, "What kind of village pizza do you like?" So I think if Senator Wieger drops the ball, the tax conferees are probably
covered.
Still going to get some village pizza from Representative Lilly. So, well, Senator Mwah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Belanger used to really be a heavy lifter in the tax conference committee. So,
Senator Belanger was.
Yep. So it would be good to.
We're Senator Rosen, we're still waiting for the next Senator Belanger. I mean, Senator Belanger voted for tax bills because he wanted to be at the table doing the deal. And I don't think there's anybody who ever sat at this table or sat out in that audience that didn't have a huge amount of respect for Senator Belanger because he wanted to be at the table to be doing the deal. But we seem to be all caught up in our partisan stripes. We don't have enough people that want to do the deal anymore.
Well, don't sell us so hard, Mr. Chair. Some of us want to keep staying at the table.
But, I mean, really. I mean, Senator Belanger did. I mean, he, you know, I don't believe it ever cost him an election. I don't know what happened in the last one, but I'm not sure. But
it wasn't the tax issue.
It was, I don't think it was the tax issue, was it? No. Senator Lillard? No. We should ask Senator Dahl, maybe. But anything else, members? We're a little past time.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just briefly, Phil Griffin with Life Science Alley. Mr. Chairman, I know we're going to have more discussions tomorrow on Senator Saltzman's bill, but we did, as one of the premier organizations representing the biosciences in the state with over 600 companies and 65,000 jobs, including Medtronic and the 162 spinoff companies of Medtronic, want to support Article 3 of Senator Rosen's bill. And I know we'll have lots more discussions about that.
Senator Ortman moves Senate File 1062 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
No, motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Mr. Chair.
Tomorrow morning, members, 8:30, we've got more economic development stuff to talk about. This committee's adjourned.